Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I am the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming from Jupiter, Florida, in the studios of WJUP 103.9 FM, Sunday morning, April 24th, 2016. One can also hear this program live streaming. My guest this morning is Dr. Terry Galway. Our subject is the Irish immigration and the rise of Tammany Hall and machine politics. As I say each week, the mission of the Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues, public policy, and public affairs. Therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. Welcome, Dr. Terry Galway, to the Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Terry Galway is the senior editor at Politico New York, a former professor of history at Kane University, and a longtime journalist and historian. He's the author of Machine Made and the Creation of Modern American Politics. He was the director of the John Keane Center for American History at Kane University in Union, New Jersey, a former member of the New York Times editorial board, city editor for the New York Observer. I think they call, is it the Kane, what is the nut, what's your nickname for Kane University? It's Terry, do you remember?
Well, it's been called a lot of things. I'm willing to impart what it's been called.
All right.
But it's a public university about 15 minutes from my house.
Okay. Dr. Galway served as the consultant to the museum in New York for its 2008 exhibit, Catholics in New York, and he edited a book of essays about Catholics in New York published by Fordham University Press. He was awarded his PhD from Rutgers University. I always mention my daughter's Dana's alma mater. He has appeared on several documentaries on PBS, the History Channel, and has been a frequent contributor to American Heritage, the Boston Globe, the New York Times. He previously appeared on The Advocates in February 2012 and January 2010 with discussions about FDR at 130 years old and the New Right Revisionism, and his book, FDR, Together We Cannot Fail. You know, one of the hottest topics in American politics today is immigration. Throughout the 20th century, it has been an issue, and since the period from 1921 through 1924, during the Harding and Coolidge administrations, strict limitations were put in place regarding who and how many immigrants could enter into the United States. The issue seems to be always who came here first and therefore who has the greatest claim on the American dream. On April 21st, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a man descended from people who came over on the Mayflower, stated in a speech at Constitution Hall, the bastion of blue-blooded Protestantism, to the Daughters of the American Revolution, and I quote, "Remember, remember always that all of us, and you and I especially, are descended from immigrants and revolutionists. Most in attendance were political opponents of FDR and his New Deal, and frankly were quite shocked that he reminded them of their heritage. Therefore, with that in mind, Dr. Galway, can you set the stage regarding the Irish immigration of the 1850s, what they faced as immigrants, who they were, and who were the know-nothings of that era?"
Well, the period that you're referring to is the period of the Irish famine. So what was happening in New York and in other seaport cities in the United States is there was a huge influx of poor Irish people. They were Catholic. Many of them didn't speak English, although we think of Irish people as English speakers, understandably. But back then, many of the immigrants still spoke their native Gaelic language, so they really were outsiders. They were like no other immigrants who had come before, including other Irish immigrants, who before the 1850s had tended to have skills and were more educated. These people literally were fleeing starvation. It was either stay in Ireland and die or do what you could to get to the New World. So they landed in New York and Boston and Baltimore, Philadelphia, with nothing but the clothes they were wearing. And they inspired the Know-Nothing Movement, which was a movement of nativists, of people who felt that these immigrants would never fit in because they were poor, because they were Catholic. They didn't understand concepts of American liberty, which they, the nativists, associated with Protestantism and with sort of Anglo-Saxonism. So these nativists were convinced that nothing good would come of this immigration. So as a result, Catholic churches were burned down. There were riots in the streets. And these immigrants had a very hard time fitting in.
You know, in your fascinating book, Machine Made, you don't go back to the origins of Tammany Hall of the 1790s, but you go back to Ireland and the root causes of the giant immigration, the unbelievable immigration, one could say, that changed America. Terry, and I'll call you Terry, I think that's a little easier than doctor because I always think of going to get a physical. What was happening in Ireland, and what was the impetus that brought this great wave of immigration ashore, to our shores? How desperate was it?
Oh, it was desperate. And the reason for the famine and for the immigration and the starvation was quite simple. The Irish didn't own the land they worked on. You know, the English had started to come over hundreds of years earlier. They, in essence, stole the lands of the native Catholics, appropriated it to themselves, and now the Irish were relegated to being, for the most part, not every Irish person, but for the most part, many Irish Catholics were tenant farmers working land they didn't own, although their ancestors may have owned it. And as part of the exchange, as part of the market, in Ireland, the crops were designated to pay the rent, and they were, in essence, the landlord's crops, and the Irish people themselves lived on potatoes. You know, and today we sort of laugh at the idea of a potato famine. I mean, it's actually been the subject of very bad jokes on ESPN and elsewhere. But, you know, it was very real and very dire when the potato crop on which most Irish people depended on.
Right.
I think it's estimated that 5 million of Ireland's 8 million people in 1845 depended on the potato as their only food. Some Irish people in 1848 ate as many, this is hard to believe, as 12 pounds of potatoes a day. So when the crop fails, they die, or they starve, or they emigrate. And within 8 years or so of Ireland's 8 million people as of 1840, within 12 years, Ireland's population has diminished by about 2 million, maybe more. And so many of them died, but another 1.5 million, maybe more, emigrated. Not all to the United States, some to Canada, some to Australia, but obviously the United States did get the bulk of that immigration. And as I said, it was immigration the likes of which the United States had never seen before, and I would argue probably the first of the huddled masses that we associate with emigration today. Before the Irish famine, emigration was much more orderly and tended to, the immigrants themselves tended to be skilled in some way. These people were not skilled. The only thing they knew how to do was work the land. And interestingly enough, they chose not to work the land in the United States. They decided to stay in cities. So these rural people, rural, in many cases illiterate people, decide that they would never again work the land that had failed them. They would, take their chances in the cities of the United States.
You know, to put this in context so people understand the passion and the story of Ireland, remember, it's 100 years ago this past Easter that the Easter Revolt happened in Ireland, and this was a revolt against the English, and this culminated in literally a war of independence for free Ireland till 1923. Basically, you had the division between Northern Ireland, the counties in Ulster, and it's very interesting that it didn't end there, because there were actually more casualties. We talk about terrorism today. More casualties. Over 3,000 lives were lost in Ireland in the 1970s and 80s up until the agreement with Clinton and Mitchell regarding than there were in the Easter Revolt and the whole war against England up till 1923. So this is this conflict and the reenacting of the Battle of the Boyne and the Black and Tans, this went on, and this was part of the reality of what we saw, the American people saw with immigration coming in the 1850s. America, getting back to this period, from the time the American Revolution through the 1840s, was almost completely a Protestant country, dominated by the people from Great Britain, along with German descendants of the thousands of Hessians and other mercenaries brought over by England to fight against the revolution, revolutionary colonists in the American Revolution. So, Terry, aside from other European immigrants fleeing to America in 1848 because of violence and the upheaval in their countries, what made the Irish different? And again, where did they settle and why? You brought a little bit about that. They didn't want to go to the farms. What made them comfortable in the cities?
Well, I think what made them comfortable in the cities is that there were other people like them, because there had been already some Irish immigration. But what made them different is that they were Catholic, and they were poor. And as you suggested, the United States up until the 20th century, and frankly, well into the 20th century, America saw itself as a Protestant country in ways that I think you have to be of a certain age to remember that. Today we sort of are in a much more secular country, and this is, where multiculturalism probably, has its benefits, because, as late as the 1920s, most Americans thought of the United States as a Protestant country. But in any case, so they are Catholic, they are poor, and they come landing in the seaports of the Northeast and staying there, literally some of them getting off the ships and looking for the first sign that says for rent, or depending on a politician, a member, say, of Tammany Hall in New York, who would guide them to where they could find an apartment to rent, and then they would, through maybe their friends, maybe their relatives, maybe through Tammany Hall, they would obtain employment and would never again rely on the soil, which had failed them so miserably in Ireland. And, they sort of became this urban proletariat, very much competing in some cities with the free blacks, which led to all sorts of racial tension, which explodes later on during the Civil War. Mm. But, I would argue that, as I said before, that these are the first of the huddled masses that we would then see, throughout the 19th century into the 20th and arguably into the 21st as well.
Now, there were also Irish who came to New Orleans and Louisiana. And they had tremendous problems there with climate and adjustment. What happened to those Irish, and what kept them from staying other than dying? What was their fate?
Well, I think they sort of assimilated into the larger southern culture. And part of the impetus for coming to New Orleans is that there were canals to build in Louisiana. And basically that's where the Irish wanted to work, which is something we need to remember or remind ourselves sometimes, that people came here to work because there was no work to be had where they had been born. So they wanted to work the canals in New Orleans, and as you suggest, the climate in New Orleans was slightly different than the climate in Ireland. Because there was no sort of center of Irish community life, as there was in New York and Boston and the cities of the Northeast, I think that many of these Irish immigrants sort of blended into the larger southern culture, and in many ways, although I'm sure they left their legacies, and they're still one of the largest St. Patrick's Day parades in the country is actually in Savannah, Georgia, an odd place you would think for a St. Patrick's Day parade, but they did assimilate more into southern culture than they did right away in New York, where, as I said, they had these institutions which sort of kept them, if you will, for lack of a better phrase, in the cultural ghettos. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that they were settled in neighborhoods where they lived with people like themselves.
And it's interesting that the O'Hara family was the nexus, the center of the story of Gone with the Wind.
I know. You know, I've never figured that out. Of course, we see Gone with the Wind these days, and we cringe at some of the stereotypes and some of the ways that slavery is portrayed. But yet, at another level, it really is sort of fascinating that Margaret Mitchell, the author of Gone with the Wind, chose as the slaveholding family, you know, the
right.
centerpiece of the story, these Irish Catholics. I don't know that there were a whole lot of wealthy Irish Catholics in Georgia before and during the Civil War, but apparently there was one anyway, at least
right.
a fictional one, and that is the O'Hara's.
Well, it's sort of interesting that, and you bring that up, that Birth of a Nation, which was thought at its time as the greatest American film, even Woodrow Wilson admired it, etc., became quickly a pariah to African-Americans in the country, liberals, progressives, northerners who looked at it, God almighty, what a stereotypical film. And then you move 20 years later to Gone with the Wind, and you have people admire it and say this is one of the by far the greatest film ever made, and it lasted that way for decades after that. And now again we look back another generation and say, is that really how it was? Isn't this rationalization, etc.? But of course, that family was seen in the film as a religious Irish Catholic family. And of course, the question, remains, were they prototypical or was, and of course, when you go down to Georgia, and I believe that, you know, there were Catholics in Georgia, and you go back to Margaret Mitchell, of course, and that was people she knew of, and she wrote about it. You know, those, you can find out there were examples in the past of characters that she was told about or knew, etc., when she started writing that book in the early 1930s. Of course, this is another part of the saga of America. And as Franklin Roosevelt said, you know, we're descended from, you know, immigrants and revolutionists. And, you know, it's part of our heritage we shouldn't really deny. And part of our greatness is this melting pot, even though people have decried that the use of that term, that we've taken the best and the brightest into this country. You know, the people who want to get on a boat and sail across the Atlantic and take all those risks are pretty bold people, you know?
Yes, absolutely.
And that's basically how America was settled, by bold people. You know, before we hear a word from our sponsors, this is The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP 103.9 FM in Jupiter, Florida, April 24th, 2016, Sunday mornings. This show begins at 8 a.m. I've been talking to my guest, Dr. Terry Galway. We've been discussing the Irish immigration, the rise, and we'll get into the rise of American politics in a few seconds. Welcome back to The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP 103.9 FM in Jupiter, Florida, on Sunday morning, April 24th at 8 a.m. We start at that hour. I've been talking to my guest, Dr. Terry Galway, who's been here before in the past, talking about issues that are important to all Americans. And we've been discussing the rise of American politics. We're going to get into that in the wake of the immigration of the Irish in the 1850s. You know, Terry, in the 1850s, many Irish, as you have articulated, came to the United States, sought freedom of religion, an escape from poverty and hunger that beset Ireland because of British absentee ownership, the Corn Laws, and obviously the potato blight. Terry, how many people came here in reality, and how did Tammany Hall become the advocate for their rights?
Well, the exact figure is hard to get at with any precision, because some immigrants went to Canada first, and the reason for that is because some landlords in Ireland during the famine felt, well, maybe the most efficient use of this land is to rid it of its tenants. So assisted immigration, as it was called, was cheaper if you went to Canada because I believe it had to do with British shipping. And Canada, of course, was a British possession. So it was cheaper to send people to Canada, and then they would work their way back down to the United States. But I think most scholars I've read will figure that about a million people or more came during the famine. And then if you sort of look at the peak immigration, beginning with the famine and going through to the 1880s, certainly multiple millions of Irish people from a very small place, mind you. Today Ireland still has fewer people on the whole of the island, including Northern Ireland. Ireland has fewer people today than it did in 1840. And I don't know that that's true of any other European country. I'm sure that Ireland is unique in that regard. And, of course, that's sadly unique because so many people have felt they have to leave even today. But so you have these poor, in many cases illiterate, hungry people landing in cities, and political machines, the most famous of which is Tammany Hall, looking at these people and saying, all right, there's two ways we can react. One is we can react the way the Whig Party reacted, which was, for the most part, these people cannot be assimilated, they have to be stopped, we're going to alienate them from American society. Or you could be, as Tammany Hall and the other Democratic machines acted, you could say, these people are potential voters,
Right.
And if we help them, they may help us. I mean, it was a calculation. It wasn't done out of any sort of sense of benevolence, although I think that did come later. But the first reaction was one of pure calculation. How can we best help ourselves? And one of the ways to do that was to help these immigrants.
You know, many Americans familiar with history would think of Boss Tweed when it comes to city-dominated machine politics and the power of Tammany Hall and its corruption. In your narrative, he's pretty much a minor figure. With that in mind, who was Charles Francis Murphy, and how did he rise to power?
Charles Francis Murphy should be the face of Tammany Hall. As you said, Boss Tweed is often portrayed. I mean, all of the history books have Boss Tweed. He was the head of Tammany Hall right after the Civil War and only shortly thereafter, maybe about 5 years. Charles Francis Murphy was the boss of Tammany Hall from about 1902 until his death in 1924. Very important time span in New York history and, I would argue, American history. And he came through the ranks of Tammany. You know, like many other ambitious Irish men, they joined Tammany. They became involved in politics because that was fun. Imagine that, fun.
Sure.
I mean, it was a thing to do. It was a way to get prestige, being involved in politics. How times have changed. And because he was very good at his job, and his job consisted of advocating for his constituents, he could be found under a lamppost at the corner of 20th Street and 2nd Avenue in New York every night. If you had a problem, if you had a complaint, you knew that your local ward healer, your local party hack, would be there from, I don't know, 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock to hear your complaints. And because of that kind of work, people at Tammany noticed, and then when boss Richard Croker, undoubtedly corrupt, had to leave New York in a hurry. Tammany needed a new boss, and they chose Charles Francis Murphy. And so it was Murphy who presided over Tammany for basically the bulk of the Progressive Era.
Yeah, so one could just see the show Fiorella and remember the song The Little Tin Box.
Yeah.
And then reflect on how people became very wealthy on a very low salary.
Yes.
But, of course, I don't think much has changed. Maybe the style has changed a bit.
Right.
You know, not all corruption was either promulgated by new immigrants or specifically the Irish from the period of the 1850s through the turn of the century. There were reform groups that battled the abuse of crime, poverty, degradation, blight, and violence. Who are these reformers, and how did they react to the growing political power of Tammany Hall in the late 19th century?
Well, the reformers were of two sorts. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt would be a prototypical political reformer. He came to power in New York in the 1880s, elected as a very young assemblyman. I think he was about 22 years old when he was elected to the New York legislature. Immediately got a reputation as a dude. And, you know, that was a phrase not necessarily used as a compliment in 1882. And then you had the moral reformers, people like a reverend named Charles Parkhurst, who was appalled at the degradation that he saw around him. Some of it was explainable. Gambling, you know, for example, gambling offended Parkhurst and many other moral reformers. But you know, I'm a Catholic, and I can tell you that gambling is not really thought of as one of the real terrible vices.
Right.
I mean, growing up, there was bingo. There were all sorts of games of chance, frankly. So Catholics have never had that same sort of attitude towards gambling as Protestants did. But this guy, Parkhurst, went undercover, so to speak, and you know, revealed to New York that there was this sort of underworld of gambling, of prostitution, of saloons opening on Sundays when they shouldn't be, because the law said that you couldn't open a saloon on a Sunday, but you could go have a drink at the Union Club, where Teddy Roosevelt was a member. So those are the two sorts of reformers, the people who thought that the politics needed to be cleansed of people like Charles Francis Murphy and the Tammany types, and then the moral reformers who felt that the poor were poor in part because of their character flaws.
Yeah. You know, I'm reminded when you mention, is there gambling going on here? Probably one of the great lines from Casablanca, where Captain Renault closes down Rick's place, and one of the croupier gives him his winnings.
Right,
you know?
Exactly. That is, you know, you can, I watched Casablanca on Turner Classic Movies the other day, and probably for the, you know,
8 billionth time.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? That line, you still laugh when you hear, you know it's coming.
Right.
You know exactly how Claude Rains is going to deliver the line, and you laugh anyway.
Well, that's the beauty of pictures like that. You don't you know the ending. You know the beginning. You know everything about it, in fact. And it's so well written, you know. And interestingly enough, in the early days, even though it was honored pretty early, maybe because of the North African invasion, all the things that happened in that period, many people in the first 10 or 15 years after that film was made considered it full of cliches. And to tell you the truth, those cliches are loved today.
Absolutely.
So it's a very interesting juxtaposition. The same thing went on with, of course, Birth of a Nation or Gone with the Wind. You know, different generations look at things as they did in the past. And getting back to what you said, you know, there was a great impetus in that period of the Protestant blue nose. We'll call them the blue nose reformers, especially that was the Anti-Saloon League, the people like Carrie Nation, the people, of course, who wanted suffrage for women. That was a different kind of reform. There were also people that were anti-sex, who had these laws about, you know, how people acted. And, you know, I don't want to get into this, get into the detail of that.
Right, but we take your point. Yeah.
The Kellogg, I believe there was an individual named Kellogg who involved with the cereal family, who was one of these people. Maybe they were like the Shakers. You know why the Shakers disappeared? They didn't believe they didn't believe in sex.
Right.
So
exactly.
That's a pretty strange situation. You know, we sort of move on for one reason or another. Most people know. So it was a very interesting period of this conflict, and almost the rise of the Tammany reformers. We'll probably get into that a bit. Maybe it's hard for people to believe. You know, before we hear a word from our sponsors, this is The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP 103.9 FM radio in Jupiter, Florida, April 24th, Sunday morning. We always start at 8 a.m. I've been talking to my guest, Dr. Terry Galway, and we've been discussing how American politics evolved into almost the modern age through the machine politics he writes about in his great book, Machine Made, and Tammany Hall. We'll be back in a few seconds. Welcome back to The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP 103.9 FM radio in Jupiter, Florida on Sunday morning at 8. It starts at 8 a.m. I've been talking to my guest, Dr. Terry Galway, and we've been discussing the rise of American politics. Of course, a lot of it comes out of the cities, the Irish immigration, and Tammany Hall and beyond. You know, modern American politics emerged and evolved after the Civil War with not only a realignment of power, the change in demographics, the defeat of the South, Reconstruction, but the Republicans ascended in a long period that reflected dominance practically to the New Deal. You know, Terry, with that in mind, how did Tammany serve as the vehicle for the resurrection of the Democratic Party in the cities, especially New York?
Well, as you said, Republicans were in power, basically dominated the federal government, you know, from the time of Abraham Lincoln until the time of FDR, really. I mean, the only two presidents, Democratic presidents, were elected in that span, Grover Cleveland and Woodrow Wilson.
Right.
At the local level, it was much more contested. In New York in particular, was very Democratic, but as you suggest, you know, coming out of the Civil War, Democrats were often accused of having been traitors or certainly sympathetic to traitors. And one of the ways in which Tammany sort of revived the party is, first of all, nobody would have ever accused Tammany Hall of being soft on slavery, or
right,
certainly soft on the South anyway, because they had raised their own regiment. They had done a wonderful job of recruiting soldiers for the Union Army. So Tweed actually was commended for his work by the federal government in recruiting people for the Union Army. So one way they revived the Democratic Party was simply by being good supporters of the Union cause, never mind that it was being led by a Republican president. Then, you know, as immigration continued in the 1870s and 1880s, and now immigration is changing in New York, you're seeing Eastern European Jews, you're seeing Southern Italians, and by now Tammany is in Irish hands. One of the ways in which the party, the Democratic Party in New York, flourishes during that time is by bringing these new immigrants in, just as the Irish had been brought in by Tammany, so that the party is constantly reinventing itself. And I think what's important to remember about Tammany, as opposed to other machines that you may have heard of, for example, the Curley machine in Boston, named after James Michael Curley, the longtime mayor and governor, or the Hague machine, named after Frank Hague.
I am the law, right.
He was mayor of Jersey City from 1917 to 1948, something like that. But these machines were associated with an individual.
Right.
Tammany was an institutional machine,
right,
so that it was able to move from leader to leader to leader without any sort of chaos, and with all of its principles being handed down from one boss to another. So I think that sort of stability in Tammany Hall, and the fact that it wasn't a cult of personality, as Hague and Curley's machines probably were,
and Pendergast,
I think that helped too.
No question. You know, in the Murphy era, Tammany seemed to reach its peak. Two key individuals rose in that era to prominence. Who were they, and how did their reform efforts contrast with Tammany and the old Protestant good government proponents of the Theodore Roosevelt era? Who were those two?
Charles Murphy raised to power two of the greatest politicians in New York history, and arguably two of the greatest in American history, 20th century American history. They were Al Smith, who was the four-time governor of New York, and Robert Wagner, one of the great senators, United States senators, not just from New York, but in American history. And they were both grew up poor. Smith grew up in the Lower East Side of an Irish mom and a dad who was half German and half Italian, but Smith chose to identify himself as Irish. He didn't know very much about his father's family, so he just thought he was Irish, right? And that's how he identified himself. Robert Wagner actually was an immigrant. His family moved to the Yorkville section of Manhattan, which they would not be able to afford today. They, I guess, when Wagner was about 7 or 8 years old when they moved to the United States. Again, both of them were ambitious. They joined their local political club to get involved in civic life, because that's what you did in the late 19th century. They were terrific workers for the party and were rewarded. Smith was nominated for the state assembly in 1903. Wagner also went to the assembly a little bit later. And then both just rose up because Murphy, Charles Murphy, the Tammany boss, saw in them a new sort of Tammany Hall. These were two individuals who were not interested in graft. They weren't interested in the rackets. They were interested in social progress. They were very much creatures of the age. We're talking about the early 20th century now. Teddy Roosevelt is president. You know, that everybody is self-consciously progressive. And here you have two public officials from the streets of New York who clearly are determined to make government work to make the lives of people like themselves and their parents better. Mm. And so they did, you know, through the teens, 20s. And then, of course, Wagner becomes the great legislator of the New Deal.
Of course, yeah. The Wagner Connolly Act, which is the the Bill of Rights for Labor and many other acts. Yeah. Robert Wagner, and of course, for people who don't remember, he was the father of the three-time mayor of New York, Robert F. Wagner Jr., and a grandson who was involved with New York. Died quite young. You know, yeah. In 1912, Tammany seemed to reach its zenith when it came to power and influence. What was unique about that year, and what had happened?
Well, in 1911, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire killed more than 140, mostly young women. It was a factory fire in New York on the 8th floor, and that got people's attention. Labor unions began to demand better working conditions. But what was equally important in terms of getting things to happen in the legislature is that that Murphy had placed Smith and Wagner at the head of the two houses of the legislature in New York. And again, these are new-fashioned politicians. These are not old-fashioned political hacks from the 19th century. They knew what life was like for ordinary New Yorkers. And once the factory fire happened in 1911, a commission was founded to investigate the causes, and Wagner and Smith were put in charge of that commission, and that could not have been done without Murphy's support. Mm. And that commission began to investigate not just fire prevention, which was the ostensible reason for its coming into being, but they began to look into things, into issues like minimum wage, workers' compensation. They basically expanded their mission to look into the creation of what we would recognize today as a social safety net. And when the commission's work started to come through the legislature in 1912 and especially in 1913, you really see the beginnings in New York of what we would recognize today as that safety net, at the beginning of government taking a proactive role in trying to help people who are hurt on the job. You know, people like Al Smith's family. Al Smith's father died when he was 13. There was nothing for them, you know.
Yeah, right.
So that's really where modern state government, at least in New York, begins in around 1912, 1913.
And, of course, the great reformer, the governor of New Jersey, former president of Princeton University, where my son went, by the way, Woodrow Wilson is elected, and of course that becomes another period of the second half of the progressive era, sort of. Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, two distinctively different types, if there ever was, sort of bookending William Howard Taft in the beginning, and of course the progressive era that came out of it, Bull Moose campaign, et cetera, et cetera. This is a very dynamic age, and Tammany, New York, and city politics are right in the midst of it. Before we hear a word from our sponsors, again, this is The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP 103.9 FM in Jupiter, Florida, April 24th, 2016. Sunday mornings, our program begins at 8 a.m. I've been talking to my guest, Dr. Terry Galway, about the Irish immigration, the 1850s, the rise of American politics through Tammany Hall, and the political machines, and the emergence of the reform, the real reform movement, one could call it the second reform movement, started from Teddy Roosevelt and the muckrakers and into real now reform politics. We'll be back in a moment and talk about the rise of Franklin Roosevelt and his interest in Tammany. Welcome back to The Advocates on April 24th, 2016. This is Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP 103.9 FM radio in Jupiter, Florida. We have these broadcasts on Sunday mornings at 8 a.m. I've been talking to my guest, Dr. Terry Galway, and we've been discussing the rise of American politics through Tammany in the 1850s, all the way through the machine politics of Charles Francis Murphy, and of course the emergence of Al Smith and Robert F. Wagner. You know, in 1910, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected as basically an enemy of Tammany Hall. He was the rare upstate Protestant Democrat. He was the vanguard of a new generation of reformers like Francis Perkins and people, and Republicans like Harold Ickes that came out of Theodore Roosevelt's progressive Bull Moose campaign of 1912. Terry, how did FDR make peace with Charles Murphy, his heirs, and the other old-time politicians who dominated Tammany Hall?
He made his peace in 1917 when he was Assistant Secretary of the Navy. He had been elected to the Senate, the state Senate, in 1910 on this sort of explicitly anti-Tammany platform, as you would expect, I suppose, of somebody from Dutchess County. He referred to Murphy as a noxious weed who needed to be plucked out. You know, but this was a typical attitude of somebody from upstate towards the city machine, right? And frankly, in my view, he did not appreciate or realize the fact that Murphy was, in my view anyway, this transformational character, the person who had taken old Tammany and created a new Tammany, the Tammany of Al Smith and Robert Wagner. So I think that as he matured as a politician, he, I think, began to realize that perhaps the Tammany of his caricature was not the real Tammany. It probably didn't hurt the fact that in 1914, Franklin Roosevelt decided to run for U.S. Senate and was defeated handily in a primary by a Tammany-backed candidate. And, of course, the irony there is that, you know, Roosevelt and other reformers had been trying to get a primary law in New York to take, because they thought it would take power out of the hands of Murphy. So the very first time it's tried in 1914, the reformer, Franklin Roosevelt, loses to the Tammany candidate.
Right.
So I think part of it, I think, was that he may have realized that Tammany was a different animal, and I think some of it was pure calculation. Okay, I can't beat these guys, so maybe I've got to join these guys.
Well, one thing about FDR is he didn't forget lessons he learned the hard way. Later on with the purge and a few in the court packing, he probably regretted those too. Al Smith, the great four-time governor of New York, was a famous reformer, but one who never lost the image of the Irish machine politician, especially with his lack of formal education, his cigar, his New York accent. He needed FDR's support as early as 1924. What eventually happened to their relationship as FDR emerged as the dominant figure in New York and American politics?
Well, it's a sad story because I think that Smith lost his perspective. I mean, there's no question that Smith was a bitter man after 1932. And part of it was because, and people forget this, but Franklin Roosevelt was not exactly a sure thing going into the 1932 Democratic Convention. He faced one very big obstacle, and that obstacle was Al Smith.
Right.
Smith had run for president in 1928 and basically taken one for the team, right?
Right.
He lost in the landslide to Herbert Hoover. No Democrat was going to win in 1928. That was pretty
right.
clear, although Smith tended to blame it on the fact that he was Catholic and there was a great deal of Catholic bias, and that is absolutely true. But Franklin Roosevelt would not have won in 1928 because Republicans were riding a wave of prosperity, and, you know, Hoover was a very well-qualified candidate. He was
no
actually
question.
A terrific choice.
Yeah.
So 1932, Smith decides that, you know what, I'm going to run for president again. But he decides very late. He decides in February of 1932. Roosevelt's already declared. And so now you have the spectacle of these two New York governors. Smith had been governor in the 20s and had handpicked Roosevelt to be his successor.
Right.
And now they're running against each other. It was a, I wouldn't say it was a bitter campaign, but it was a bitter convention. Because Smith really thought he could do it, and of course he didn't. And although Smith later campaigned for Roosevelt in the fall of 1932, in my view, Smith never got over, always felt that Roosevelt should have deferred to him and that, you know, he would have been president instead of Roosevelt.
Well,
in 1932.
And of course, reflective today, Roosevelt won on the fourth ballot. Of course, it was
he won on the fourth ballot, right. And after a very clever maneuver
right.
where the Roosevelt people, fearing that they were losing momentum, the Roosevelt people do a deal with Hearst, who is Smith's sworn enemy,
right.
and Hearst is sort of backing Jack Garner from
right.
Texas, and in essence, the Roosevelt people offer Garner the vice presidency if, you know, Garner will throw his delegates to Roosevelt, which is what happened.
Right,
and that was enough. I think Smith never forgave the Roosevelt team for that, what I think was a very deft maneuver, but I think he saw it. In different ways.
We only have a minute left, Terry, and of course that was the two-thirds rule in those days. They changed it in 1936, and that sufficiently knocked off the South as being a control on the nomination. We only have a minute left. Well, what eventually killed Tammany, and how did it happen in the final minute we have?
Well, I think a couple of things killed Tammany. One, it was successful. It moved a generation of immigrants into the middle class. They began to leave New York for better places. Why were they able to do that? Because they had good jobs, because they had a future. That was one reason. Two, immigration after 1924 had slowed down as a result of the Restrictive Immigration Act, so there wasn't a new pool of immigrants to assimilate. And three, the New Deal, of course, was
right.
probably the final nail in the coffin, because if you can now get benefits as an entitlement, you no longer have to go to the local political
right.
boss and ask for help.
I think that was great. I thank you, Terry, for joining me once again. It was a great program. You know, if you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocates broadcasts, you can access on my website, www.theadvocatesradio.com, where information on my guests will be posted. Next week I'll be away, but I'll be back on May 8th with Michael Cohen, author, lecturer, and political commentator for the Boston Globe. We're going to talk a bit about politics. Again, Terry, I want to thank you. Any new projects on The Offing?
I'm thinking of writing a book about New York politics in the 1920s, and you can guess who the stars of that book would be.
And of course, and you know, it's interesting. This is a period... you know, that should be revisited because of the important characters, the remarkable characters, especially people like Fiorella LaGuardia, the rise of LaGuardia, the influence of Robert Moses, the influence of the reformers. This is really, I have a feeling this is the book that should be written. Of course, you know, Robert Carroll writes a lot about it in his great book, The Power Broker. But I think
yeah.
I think the politics of are less explored than what should be.
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, thank you very much. Thanks for coming back on. And maybe, you know, later in the year as the political, we find out where we're going. You know, we'll sit down and see it. Any thoughts on who will be the nominee? I keep on asking my guests this.
Well, I don't see any way that Donald Trump is not the nominee of the Republican Party, and I think Hillary Clinton will be the nominee of the Democratic Party.
With that in mind, you may be right. Stay well, and thank you. We'll be back next week with our next guest. Bye-bye.